Hello again, everyone, and welcome to another edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week. You're listening Post for Politics Iowa style, where we explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capital, what that news is, and what it all means. We are glad you're with us. I'm Dennis Hart, joined as always by my partner in politics, Laura Bellin of the blog site Bleeding Heartland. Laura, here we go again. Welcome.
Yes, good to be with you, Dennis.
We have lots to talk about, including a court decision about school districts and mask mandates in Iowa and a possible breakthrough on that baby formula shortage crisis. But we begin again this week with a hot button issue of abortion rights. Iowa Republican U.S. Senators Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst voted with their Republican colleagues against legislation that would have legalized abortion nationally. The vote taking place last week. Laura, this was not unexpected.
Yes, the only thing that was slightly unexpected about this vote is that the couple of Republicans in the Senate who do describe themselves as pro-choice also voted against this Democratic bill to codify Roe v. Wade, or maybe in some cases go beyond codifying Roe v. Wade. But all of the Republican senators and plus Democratic Senator Joe Manchin voted against this bill. It was 11 votes short of what they needed, the 60 votes to overcome the filibuster. So there will be no legislation to codify Roe v. Wade. In the House, when they passed this legislation last year, U.S. Representative Cindy Axney of the 3rd District had voted for it along with most
Democrats really never had a chance to pass this at all in the Senate. This was basically a show vote to put people on record.
Yes. I mean, and a lot of people wanted people on record because it's one thing to say that you support abortion access and abortion rights. But there were more than a couple of senators where there were some questions about where they stood. I think Joe Manchin's position has always been clear that he didn't support this legislation. But there were a few that there were some questions about. And so that's why Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer wanted it on the table.
We should say again, as we did last week when we devoted much of our show to this, that if Roe is overturned, Iowa residents seeking abortions will still be protected by a separate 2018 decision from the state Supreme Court that found abortion is protected as a fundamental right. But there could be a change
coming.
Yes,
and both the U.S. Supreme Court and the Iowa Supreme Court are expected to rule before the end of June. I expect the Iowa Supreme Court to wait and see what the U.S. Supreme Court does. But the 2018 ruling was a 5-2 decision on the Iowa Supreme Court. Four of those five justices are no longer on the court. The two who dissented are still on the court, and along with four who were appointed by Governor Kim Reynolds. So I think it's fairly likely that the Iowa Supreme Court will severely undermine that precedent. It is also possible that they could kick the can down the road by striking down the law that's at issue on other grounds that are unrelated to whether the Iowa Constitution protects any right to have an abortion.
We should say that the case involves
a 24-hour waiting period. And the 2018 case that established that the Iowa Constitution protects a fundamental right to an abortion struck down a 72-hour waiting period. So this bill is very similar to the one that was already struck down. But the main thing that's different is the composition of the Iowa Supreme Court.
Still much more to come on the abortion issue, and we'll be covering it every week right here on Capital Week. Also this week, some indications finally today, Monday, as we go live on Monday night, that the end of this year's legislative session could be coming a bit closer because there's going to be some action in the state Senate. Laura, this is a breakthrough after weeks of deadlock.
Yes, the Senate Appropriations Committee is finally going to start moving some of those appropriations bills, as we discussed in the past. The House Republicans have approved almost all of the budget bills. There's only one, but usually the one that is passed last before they adjourn the standings bill is the only one the House hasn't approved yet. And the Senate is sitting on all of those appropriations bills. So they're going to start to move those through. And I have heard from multiple sources that the House is expected to be back in session next Monday to start considering those budget bills as they come back from the Senate. They expect that there will be some changes. The House and the Senate Republicans have been at odds over the budget targets, the spending in certain areas of the state budget.
Now, what's caused the logjam is a big proposal by the governor to use public school money for private school scholarships. So given that there could be some movement here, Has there been movement on that issue to break the logjam?
I keep asking and I keep hearing that there still are not the votes in the Iowa House to pass that school voucher proposal. So I think that what may have occurred is that the Senate Republicans have given up on trying to strong arm the House into passing that bill. And it could be that the House Republicans have given up some ground on the budget. The House Republicans were supporting about $72 million more in state spending for the next fiscal year than the Senate. And it could be that they come down from some of those numbers.
So there's still a number of major issues that the legislature has to resolve before they adjourn, including, you know, the budget, as you've talked about, this private school tuition, but also one of my favorites, Laura, the bottle bill. Is that even going to have a shot at being resolved after 40 years?
I just don't hear anything about the bottle bill. It could be that it's one of those things. I mean, it is in the mix, I think, about the bills they're talking about. But there are a lot of bills, including some that aren't very well known, that may still be negotiated. And I just don't know. I think that some sort of school transparency, school curriculum type of bill will pass to give the governor a kind of victory on public school issue, since it looks like she's not going to get the vouchers that she wants. But I think a lot of the other issues that we've discussed in past weeks are probably not going to pass. And I'm still betting against a new version of the bottle bill.
You know, this lack of action on the bottle bill is enough to make a man, drive a man to drink iced tea, of course, just iced tea I'm talking about. What can I say?
Which all right, is not covered. The juice drinks and tea and sports drinks are not covered under Iowa's bottle bill. And it looks like that's not changing.
Oh, my. All right. Well, let's talk, speaking of legislature, that evolves into elections. And guess what? The primary is coming up on June 7th in Iowa. And early person, in-person and mail-in voting starts Wednesday, this coming Wednesday. Now, this is not the general. This is the primary that's going to determine which candidates appear on November's general election ballots. Okay, so here we go. We've got the primary early voting coming up, but there are changes in early voting.
Yeah. So if it seems a little bit late for early voting to be starting, you are correct, because for many years, Iowa's early voting period was 40 days. So for the primary, people would be able to start voting in late April. Then in 2017, that was shortened to 29 days before the election. And now it's only 20 days. So that's why the early voting is only starting on Wednesday, May 18th. That's the first day that people can show up at their county auditor's office and vote in person. And it's also the first day that county auditors can send out absentee ballots. So I've had some people say to me, I requested a ballot weeks ago and I'm checking the mail every day. And I said, well, you don't have to check the mail, because the earliest it could even be mailed to you is Wednesday, May 18th. It's not going to arrive until Thursday or Friday.
So let's give a few tips on early voting. Of course, we're not going to ask you or tell you who to vote for. That's up to you. But voting is always a good idea. I'll start it out. You go on, Laura. You have to be a U.S. citizen. You have to be an Iowa resident. You have to be at least 17 or turn 18 by election day. And you can't be mentally incompetent, judged by a court. So that lets me out. No, I'm just kidding.
That is correct. All right. All of the above. And yes, one of the big changes is that ballots have to be at the county elections office by 8 p.m. on election day. That for this primary, that's Tuesday, June 7th. So there's no mailing the ballot and making sure it has a postmark and then it'll be okay. It has to be in that office by 8 p.m. on election day. So I am encouraging people, if they have requested a mail ballot, either get that relative or someone in your household hand deliver it if possible, because that's the safest way. Early voting in person is also a way that you go to the office, you request the ballot, fill it out right there and leave it right there. You don't take it with you. You just leave it and you know that it was turned in on time. So those are the most secure ways for people to make sure that their ballots are in, if they either hand deliver a mailed ballot or
I think maybe the biggest impact the new laws are going to have involves having to have that ballot in by 8 o'clock on election night. You can't, as you have said, and as is the case in some other states, you can't mail it in by election day and have it arrive a day later. It doesn't count.
And I think that at minimum hundreds and possibly thousands of ballots are not going to be counted for that reason. If people are used to the old system and thinking, well, if I mail it a few days before the election, and with the Postal Service, it doesn't seem like the delays are as long as they used to be, but especially for people in rural areas, you might live only 10 or 15 miles from your your county elections office, but your mail may actually be sent to another county to a mail processing center to be sorted and then sent back to your home county. So there can be a delay of several days.
And also, there is a deadline on requesting an absentee ballot to vote by mail. You not only can't do it too early, you can't request one too late here.
That's right. So the deadline is May 23rd. So it's 15 days before the election. It used to be you could request a ballot up to 10 days before the election. And I think that where this is really going to trip some people up is if they requested a mail ballot, if the mail ballot arrives and they make a mistake while filling it out, and it happens sometimes. In the old days, it was very common for people to just call the county auditor's office and they'd say, don't worry about it, we'll send you a replacement packet. But at this point, the county auditors can't mail any ballots to anybody after that May 23rd point, 5 days before the election. So if you get your ballot, leave it on the table for a few days, then start to fill it out and have a problem, it's going to be too late for you to get that replacement ballot. You'll have to go to the auditor's office in person or take your incomplete or spoiled ballot with you on primary election day and surrender it at your regular polling place and vote with a regular ballot. People will still be able to vote on June 7th from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. So that's still an option. But of course, you know, many people have busy schedules. They may be out of town. They may have a medical emergency or a caregiver emergency. So that's why a lot of people like to get their voting out of the way early.
So let's again be specific. By the time you hear us again next Monday night, you're right on the deadline for requesting absentee ballot. It's May 23rd next Monday.
That's right. And at this point, at that point, it's the safest thing would be for people to vote early in person. And all of the county auditor's offices will be open on weekdays. And I think the one or two Saturdays before the primary election as well, they'll be open for several hours for people to go and vote early in person. And usually the lines aren't very long to do that.
All right, let's get down into the down and dirty of actual voting here. You wrote today on Bleeding Heartland about who votes. You've analyzed a great analysis. Who votes in the Democratic primary in Iowa? Why don't you explain that?
Well, I looked at the last three competitive statewide primaries. So that would be the 2016 U.S. Senate race, the 2018 governor's race, and the 2020 Senate primary. All of those years, there were very competitive Democratic, multi-candidate primaries. And I was just interested to see who voted, which kind of groups are voting. And what I found was that whether it was the 2016 primary that had relatively low turnout or the 2020 primary, which had extremely high turnout, because you may remember during the pandemic, Secretary of State Paul Pate mailed absentee ballot request forms to all registered voters across the state. And so the turnout level was more than 2.5 times as high as it had been in 2016. But the proportions of who was voting in those primaries really didn't change very much. So the three main characteristics I was looking at were age. So the predominant group of voters in a Democratic primary are people over 50. And a lot that may surprise a lot of people who think, well, aren't a lot of young people more liberal? And that may be that statistically, young people may be more likely to vote for Democrats. But in Iowa, given the aging population and just how large those older age cohorts are, there were about 80% of the primary voters in 2016 and around 70% of the primary voters in 2018 and 2020 were at least 50 years old. The second thing I looked at was gender. This is probably less surprising for people because there has been a gender gap for quite some time, and more registered Democrats are women than men, and that's translated into more women than men voting in primaries, anywhere from about 57% in 2016 to just under 60% in 2020 of the Democratic primary voters are women. And I also looked at what counties people live in and found that at least 60% or perhaps up to 65% of the Democratic primary voters live in the 10 largest counties. And then the 16 counties after that, which I call the mid-sized counties, they tend to have the smaller cities. Boone is one, Marshall is one, that are close to KHOI's listening area, that those counties also have about 17-18% of the primary electorate. But what it comes down to is that about 80% of the Democratic primary voters live in about a quarter of the state's counties.
Okay, we're going to take a deep breath because we have plenty more to go and only a few minutes left to go there. It is 15 after the hour. Wherever you're listening to us, you are in tune with KHOI Radio's Capital Week. We're your one-stop source for everything political going on in Iowa. As always, I'm Dennis Hart, and as always, she's Laura Bellin, and we're here every week this time to talk politics, Iowa style, how it's affecting all of us. There is a new poll floating around the world of Iowa politics this Monday evening, Laura, one showing that Mike Franken has pulled into a virtual tie with Abby Finkenauer in the race to the Democratic nomination for the U.S. Senate seat now held by Chuck Grassley. This is stunning.
Yes, and this is true. We should be cautious because this is a poll that the Franken campaign released. It was conducted by Change Research. It was commissioned by the Franken campaign, and it was in the field last week, and earlier this month, and it found that 42% of Democratic primary voters, likely primary voters, supported Franken, and 40% supported Abby Finkenauer. There is a third candidate in the primary, Glenn Hurst, as well. And this was, according to the Franken campaign, this was a big change from their previous poll, which they hadn't released to the public, that showed that Finkenauer had basically a 2-1 lead, 53% to 26%. That was in early April.
If this is true, what does this say about the state of Finkenauer's campaign? We know she had trouble staying on the ballot. She had to go to the Supreme Court for that, the state Supreme Court. We know that he has a lot of money now vis-a-vis her. What does this say?
Well, I think it says, again, has been running for the last 4 weeks, have been effective, if these polls are accurate. And the article in Inside Elections that reported on this said that the Franken campaign has spent $481,000 on broadcast and cable TV over 4 weeks. The Finkenauer campaign has not run any television ads yet. They are supposedly going to go up on TV this week, but with a smaller buy than what the Franken campaign has been spending. So that has been possibly effective. I know that before the 2018 primary, the Fred Hubbell's campaign for governor vastly outspent all of the other candidates, and not just on TV ads, but also on paid media like direct mail. And that was one factor that led to his commanding victory in that primary.
Has long been considered Abby Finkenauer the front runner and the going to join.
It's possible, but I mean, I think that her campaign just doesn't have a lot of money, and that's still aren't up on TV. And they may be going up on TV this week, but as I said, not spending very much. I mean, the overall, if you look at the past year, the Finkenauer campaign has raised more money than Franken, but they've also spent a lot more larger percentage of what they've raised. We've talked about this, their burn rate before at the end of the year and also at the end of the first quarter when we were looking at the numbers. During the first 3 months of the year, Finkenauer's campaign spent about 95% of what they raised. And so that's creating a big problem. And a few weeks ago, on Abby Finkenauer's website, there was a notice up about, it was labeled media, and it was about what people in Iowa's largest TV markets need to hear about Abby Finkenauer. And in effect, it was a script of a TV ad that they would like someone to run. This is something that campaigns do when they want outside groups to come in and spend money. And so I wondered when I saw that, whether Emily's List, for instance, which endorsed Abby Finkenauer last year, whether they might come in and drop a lot of money on TV ads for her before this primary. So far, they have not. Now, it's possible that they will before June 7th, but it's getting kind of late now.
Very quickly on this next one, Governor Reynolds drew some hoo-ha last week for encouraging a crowd at a campaign event to elect Republicans for state attorney general and auditor, asking specifically for someone who is, in her words, not trying to sue. Every time they turn around, she's talking about Rob Sand, who's never sued her, and Tom Miller. So she was being pretty open. She wants Republicans in those positions, attorney general and auditor. And
I think it's not unusual for the governor to say that I'd like you to vote for Republicans down ballot. Certainly Terry Branstad, when he was governor, tried to get people to vote for Republican candidates for attorney general. But I think the way the governor said it, and this was a video put up on social media and then broadcast as well, where she said, I want my own AG, please. I want my own AG. And so that is kind of a different expression, because the attorney general is a separate constitutional office. It's not the attorney general doesn't report to the governor, isn't subordinate to the governor. And so for her to say that she wants her own AG, I think that was where she got a lot of the criticism. And then, as you mentioned, say implying that state auditor Rob Sand keeps trying to sue her, when in fact courts that questioned some of the spending. saying that she approved, but that's
and quickly on this one, you reported on Bleeding Heart Land. You busy reporting last week on Bleeding Heartland, Laura. No sleep there. That's to talk about this one, about litter boxes in public private school scholarships. What is this litter boxes on in public schools thing?
So I have to give credit to Kelby Wingard of the Fort Dodge Messenger newspaper, because she was on the case. There was a legislative forum and the local state senators and representatives were there. And of course, the school voucher bill was a hot topic. And Senator Kreinbrink made this comment. Now, the litter boxes in public schools, I think we talked about this a few months ago, because this rumor has gone around. I believe it started in Michigan last year. And the Carroll County superintendent, it got so bad in Carroll County that the superintendent had to send out a district-wide email saying, this isn't happening. Nothing like this is happening. And a lot of people have connected this rumor with the idea of transgender students being able to use the bathroom that aligns with their gender identity, because the hoax that schools are accommodating students who identify as animals and putting litter boxes in restrooms, of course, that's not happening anywhere in Iowa or anywhere else. But this rumor is something that school officials have had to beat down in a number of states.
Right, and we should say there's not a shred of evidence that any of that.
No, and I, in fact, then called the superintendents, all the superintendents in Tim Kreinbrink's Senate district, just to confirm that this has happened. It hasn't come up in their district. And he didn't say, I shouldn't have said that. It wasn't true. He said, I misspoke. What I meant to say was that there was one school board that was asked to put litter boxes in restrooms, but they declined the request. And I'm certain that that didn't happen either. I'm in the process of submitting public records requests to all of the school districts in his Senate district, just to confirm. But based on my conversations with all of the superintendents in his Senate district, I can confidently say that did not happen.
Let's move quickly on here to today, this afternoon, Monday. A court released its decision on Iowa school mask law. It's the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals decided to vacate a preliminary injunction on new law.
This was a confusing case, and we talked about it last September. So the federal district court last September put a hold on that law, an injunction, and said that the state cannot ban mask mandates in schools. And a number of school districts then reinstated mask mandates. So the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the region that includes Iowa, they originally heard this case in November. I thought they'd come up with a ruling quickly. They didn't. They came up with kind of a confusing opinion in February, and then they reheard the case in March and now issued their opinion. It was a 2-1 split on the panel. So the two judges on the Eighth Circuit said this is moot. So they lifted the injunction on the mask mandate ban. So school districts in Iowa are still banned from having blanket mask mandates. However, the opinion from those two judges, it did point out that it's possible that if other laws, including federal disability law, require masks in some situations to protect vulnerable students, then it may be that certain masking is required. And that was what the state was arguing in this federal lawsuit. And so it could be that these students who were the plaintiffs in the case, who all have serious medical conditions and are immunocompromised, it could be that their families can petition the school districts to say, look, we need the students in their classroom or the teacher in their classroom to be masked to protect them. But the school districts under the Iowa law cannot just have a blanket mask requirement. And the reasoning of the two judges on the Eighth Circuit was that the situation has changed. COVID transmission levels are much lower than they were last fall when the Delta wave was dominant. And they're also lower than they were in the winter when the Omicron wave was dominant. Now, I should say there was a dissenting judge, Judge Jane Kelly. She also happens to be the only judge on the Eighth Circuit appointed by a Democrat. And she said that this was premature for the court to declare it moot, and that it's something that should go back to the lower court, and that it's very possible that federal disabilities law does require in some circumstances that masks be mandatory for certain students to give them access to that free and appropriate public education that federal law has guaranteed.
There's a lot more to say on coronavirus, but we don't have a lot of time. Coronavirus cases are increasing in Iowa in almost every respect. We'll see how this plays out. Also, there's news this afternoon that the Abbott company, and this is involving the baby formula shortage, which is at crisis levels across the country and in Iowa, has reached agreement with the Fed to help ease the nationwide shortage, but it's going to take weeks for that to play out. And meanwhile, all politicians, including Chuck Grassley and politicians in Iowa, everybody's in.
Yes, and it's been brewing for a long time, but it just hit the crisis stage recently. And Iowa is one of the states where there are a lot of baby formula supply shortages. And one of the issues is that the industry is so concentrated. A couple of companies supplying the overwhelming majority of the formula. And another issue is that for women who receive aid through the WIC program, every state through the WIC program only purchases formula from one manufacturer. And so it's difficult. Well, women can't just use their WIC money to go to the store and buy some other brand of formula. They're stuck with the formula that it supplies to WIC in their state. So there have been a lot of calls to the federal government to lift some of these regulations, to lift some of the restrictions on importing formula from Canada or other countries where they don't have shortages. And we'll see whether anything happens on that front. Because as you say, even after this factory in Michigan gets up and running again, it's still going to take some time to get that supply to the stores where people need to buy it. And of course, it you cannot even imagine the stress that parents would be under if they couldn't find enough.
Right. We hope that this resolves or gets resolved very quickly. It is a serious issue for many, many families across this country and in Iowa. One more note before we go. A judge decided that a lawsuit brought by several organizations, including one you're involved with, against Governor Reynolds for failing to comply with the state's orders that you're going to explore. In simple terms,
so we talked about this in December. So Bleeding Heartland and I are among the plaintiffs. This was a lawsuit that the ACLU of Iowa filed in December against the governor and some of the governor's staff and the governor's office after a delaying public records request. The governor's office then provided most of the records that we had been seeking. In some cases, we've been seeking them for more than a year. They provided most of those records in early January and then sought to have the case dismissed as moot. So the district court judge recently found that the case could proceed, that it rejected the state's motion to dismiss. And just today, I saw that the state had filed a notice of appeal, which was not surprising because in the other two open records lawsuits that are out there against the Reynolds administration, it was the same outcome, that the district court rejected the motion to dismiss, the state appealed. So it's very likely that sometime later this year, early next year, the Iowa Supreme Court will decide whether these open records lawsuits can proceed or whether they need to be dismissed as moot because the governor's office provided.
And we should say, emphasize again that the three organizations are Iowa Capital Dispatch, the Freedom of Information Council, and Bleeding Heartland. So we have a minute left. We've gone through a lot here tonight, Laura. We expect action in the legislature. I know you're going to be watching it here. It's been a while since we've had any action. What do you honestly think is going to happen in the next few days?
Well, I think that we're going to see probably the Senate alter some of the spending, lower the spending on some of those budget bills. But it really does sound like they might be able to get out of town in the next week to 10 days and be out for the year. I mean, I think that there will be some kind of capitulation from the Iowa Senate Republicans. I don't think that there's any chance that they'll be able to strong arm the House into passing that voucher bill. It is possible that they could scale back the voucher bill to something more like a pilot program that would only be in a few school districts rather than 10,000 students across the state. But I don't think that's.
And of course, we have a primary election coming up. And at some point here, we're only 3 weeks away, we will start talking about this, but we've been so busy with other matters, we haven't been able to get to it. We will, though, we promise.
Yes. Yeah. Plenty to talk about in the next few weeks.
And we'll see you next Monday,
Absolutely.
Laura.
Absolutely.
We're out of time. You have been listening to Capital Week on KHOI Community Radio. A reminder that the views and opinions expressed here did not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHOI or its staff. Laura and I will zoom right back here literally in this time slot next week, when we'll have the latest on what's going on politically inside and outside the state capitol. Until then, we thank you so much for the privilege of your time. We appreciate it and we value it. So between now and next time, we hope you have a safe, healthy, and very happy week.
We are closing the second half of Capital Week with Iowa Farmers Union President Aaron Lehman introducing us to Nick Wallace of the Farm Organization 99 Counties. Take it away, Aaron.
Well, welcome, everyone. This is the Iowa Farmers Union Lunch and Learn Series. My name is Aaron Lehman. I'm the president of the Iowa Farmers Union. I farm here just outside of Allman. And we are really glad to have with us Nick Wallace. Thank you so much for joining us, Nick.
Yeah, thanks. Appreciate you having me.
A week from today, our next Lunch and Learn will be with Jason Grimm. He's the executive director of the Iowa Valley Resource Conservation and Development, the Iowa Valley RC&D. We'll talk about the wonderful food system work that Jason is involved in, and we'll talk about what's going on his farm as well. I always learn so much when we get to talk to Jason. Well, Nick, thank you so much for joining us. You know, we are so anxious to have a good conversation with you about your farm, but have a discussion about stronger farms and healthier food, and talk about how 99 counties is building a platform for farmers and small business people and consumers, and how that all fits into regenerative farming practices. And so we are really glad that you're with us today, Nick. Thank you for being here.
Yep. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it. Yeah. I'm wearing many hats. I'll just give you just a little background, Kind of where I'm sitting. I'm in my home here, just 4 miles south of Keystone, Iowa. Mm-hmm. Keystone is 30 miles directly west of Cedar Rapids, on the way to Ames, but in between Tama and Cedar Rapids. So right here in corn and soybean country. Pretty flat before we get into the hills. And I'm on a century family old farm, 1894, on my dad's mom's side, not the Wallace side. There's some original land that's old up in by Vinton that's from my Wallace side. So a lot of roots run deep here. And we started to take this farm over and transition it maybe, I want to say 15 years ago, mm-hmm. turned it from chemical farming to biological farming. Certified organic ground. I do organic corn, oats, soybeans, hay, pasture. I have got 60 or so cows, cow calf to finish. I used to do a movable 250 hen layer house for eggs, and I used to do hoop house type pork for pork, but the derecho changed my plans, and I just haven't had the time, energy, or heart to rebuild what I want to rebuild, because I'd probably do it a little different. So I kind of keep waiting, but it's almost been 2 years, so I need to probably get back to figuring that out. That is, and then I'm a dad of three kids, 12, 9, and 5, so we're busy with ball games and soccer and track and dance recitals and all that. So, and then currently have a business called Wallace Farms that is transitioning into 99 counties, which is another brainchild of mine that I brought on investors and co-founders and other people to help, you know, drive the bus and really, you know, do some good things there. So,
well, tell us about that venture.
Yeah.
That's really exciting.
Yep. So I'm going to pull back all the way as high as we can go, 30,000 foot view. I've been direct marketing with Wallace Farms, my farm products, and then others around me. So I aggregate farmers' products. More natural farming, biological farming, and natural livestock systems. So I've been doing that almost 20 years. And I built that up to be, you know, thousands of customers and a $1 million business that I do a lot of. All the boxes go direct to the consumer. I don't do any wholesale or grocery store. About 5 years ago, after I sold a snack stick company that I created called Nick Sticks, I was frustrated that agriculture really wasn't changing. And I think that there's, like, through PFI, I go to the, you know, conferences, and I'm heavily involved in that. I just felt like we had a strong community, but were we growing enough? Were we really, I think we were growing other people, nonprofits and members, but were we really changing farmers at a scale that was important enough to make change? And if you look at the 25 million, give or take, of farmable acres in Iowa, 99% of it is still two crops, and it's controlled, right. You know, seeds and chemical are controlled by, you know, five or less companies. So my big thing is, how do we regain the farmer's sovereignty, right? To be able to freedom to plant what they want. And not to say a farmer couldn't do that now, but with what risk? I mean, everything is geared towards two crops. So we lost farmer sovereignty. We lost over the last 50 years, starting in the 70s. You know, my dad farmed in the 70s and made it through that. And then in the 80s, the interest rates jumped to 22%. He couldn't do it. And so each decade, it seems like we lose small farmers, we lose the hog farmers, we lose the poultry went a long time ago. Now it's the dairy farmers, you know, are like the last bastion, and they're gone. You know, they're being shown the door. And so our food is controlled by corporations, and you know, maybe some corporations do it better than others. I get it. They're trying to do their own regenerative initiatives and carbon sequestration. But at the end of the day, we're the small towns in Iowa that I see all the time are dwindling. There's just not a lot of energy there. There's no velocity of goods and services. It is geared towards, you know, two commodities. So I was really frustrated with that and was coming home from a conference in Minneapolis three years ago called at the Acres Conference, and was always inspired, you know, you get inspired by those winter farm conferences. And there was a model for called Tree Range that had poultry could be done on 3 acres, and it could raise either 4,500 broilers, or it could be 1,200 layers all year long on not much acres, right? And they were doing elderberry bushes and hazelnuts, and it was a really cool biodiverse system that you could make a decent amount of money and not have to have a lot of land use. So I came home going up there. I didn't see any rye, you know, I didn't see hardly anything green. I didn't see animals outside. I didn't see people outside. I just didn't, you know, I saw a dead Midwest. And so I came home, I was really frustrated, but I came home and I thought, what if we could do a poultry model in every county? And then I got to thinking, what if we could do a pork producer in every county? And what if we could do a grass-fed beef producer in every county? And then I had to Google, I grew up most of my life here in Iowa. I had to Google how many counties are in Iowa, and Siri told me 99 counties. And the marketing side of me thought, that is the perfect name for a business to reimagine and redevelop and revitalize rural America, starting with Iowa. And so I just kind of went wild. I brought in some people that were farmers and some people at PFI to start brainstorming this and start create an actual business plan around it. And it came to fruition over the last winter, and we did get investors. And we launched 99 counties. And so essentially 99 counties is the middle piece of the messiest part of the business. It's the logistics, the transportation, the packaging, the recipes, the labeling, the delivery to Chicago, the delivery to islands. And that's the part where farmers right now try to direct market. And some of them are doing it very well, but I can tell you a person who's tried to farm and raise a family and direct market and be that sales and marketing head, you only have so much time in a day, and you start to burn yourself out. It's really hard to wear all those hats and sit on the porch and watch the sunset and go to your kids' games. And so, you know, last weekend I found myself in traffic in Chicago, you know, by O'Hare, and I'm just like, oh, you know, but so I'm trying to figure out and create this paradigm shift and create this business that is like Airbnb or Uber. You know, they came on the market. Nobody had ever heard of them. They don't, you know, Airbnb doesn't own any houses. They just connect one community to another community. So what we're trying to do is build communities and try to connect those communities. And we think that we can do that in the middle. So we're offering contracts to farmers to buy their animals at the gate. And as soon as the trailer leaves, the farmer, you know, gets paid and they can go back to being a farmer. But they can make enough money that's feasible. Because right now it's really hard to just stop at the gate. They've got to take that all the way. You know, they're driving it to the processor. They're dealing with all that. They're paying all of that. And it's hard to raise, you know, production when you're grinding out the sales and marketing. So 99 counties is the middle part. We're buying animals at high quality prices for farmers to grow. We're using high quality artisan food makers, food processors, in the middle, because if you think about all the food products, most of them have to be touched by artists, and I call them artists, in the middle, you know, unless you're selling a vegetable right out of the garden, which you still have to wash and pack. But, you know, most food that farmers grow has to be value added. And so we can't forget about that. And that's what small towns in America were built on. And so we're losing that. So we're going to bring that back. And then the biggest thing is we can have the farmers and the food and all these beautiful products to eat. We don't have consumers There's no point. So Chicago's our first focus. I have a base there. We're going to get thousands and thousands of Chicago customers that are going to say, hey, I believe in 99 counties, and you're going to connect to me and story tell me and give me a QR code and a package that says where my food came from. Sure. And I'm going to give you $100, $150, or $200 a month. And I'm just going to put that on auto repeat, and it'll be the best, you know, subscription. It'll be the best charge on my statement at the, you know, when everybody looks at their statements and you're like, what am I even paying for this for?
Right.
This charge, I want people to see 99 counties and go, I am helping to make Iowa a chemical-free, regenerative, biological farming business. And 99 County is led by Nick Wallace and another group of team members that understand it, because they do farming and they understand the processing and they understand what customers want for products and how to deliver it.
Right.
And so we're just getting started. We're going to launch to the public in the fall. September is our goal. So Wallace Farms is still moving along, but it just, to me, didn't feel like it was, could be big enough to tackle this. And I see. This is kind of my, my best shot at what I've always wanted to do. And really that seed was planted by my dad. I mean,
yeah,
he got his master's in ruminant nutrition from Iowa State back in the 60s. He has been in the forage business for a long time. So he just would love to see half of Iowa in, some type of permanent or green state as of May 1st. Like, if you look at across Iowa right now, there's nothing's green, but most of my farm's green because I have rye, I've got oats, I've got hay ground. Now that isn't to say I don't rotovate up and plant some corn, and I roll down rye for soybeans, and I work it up a little bit for oats. But we're looking for diversity and building community. So that's kind of 99 counties, and we're off to a good start. So
it does sound like you're off to a great start, Nick. And so before we get any further, I will have people asking, how can I learn more? What's the best avenue to learn more? Is it to reach out to you, Nick, or do you have a landing place?
Yep, 99counties.com. And just shoot me an email. If you're a farmer producer, I'm talking to them all the time. I have two farm ambassadors that are hired underneath of us that are both farmers.
Oh, good.
That'll like onboard farmers, cause I can't do it all, but we're hoping to hire more of those. I mean, we're really hoping that this is a game changing Airbnb Uber type experience for the state of Iowa and beyond. And this isn't just, we're starting just in Iowa, but this is if a grass fed beef producer is 10 miles into Minnesota and they're doing all the right things, we're not going to not offer them. So 99 counties is just the placeholder, it travels, we think. So,
yeah.
But yeah.
Well, good. And so what's been the biggest challenge so far? I know that you talked about just how difficult it is for us to be producers at the same time we're trying to deal with all sorts of logistics of and marketing and that type of thing. What's where's the biggest challenge so far? And
yeah, my biggest challenge is probably, talk about picking a time to start a business where you're trying to get farmers to transition over to, cause we're not, I should state this. We feed grains to we're starting with chickens, hogs, and grass fed beef. So the grass fed beef is just forage. The hogs and chickens, we're feeding a non-chemical grain.
Uh-huh.
So it's on the way to organic, if you want to feed organic. But the problem is I started when commodity corn is $8.
Yeah.
So those farmers a couple of years ago who would have been all for, like, let's put 10% of our portfolio into organic and transition. Those farmers are like, I know $8 isn't going to last forever, but right now I'm crazy not to, turn and burn and try to grow as much as I can in the commodity side. But we are getting farmers that in their heart, they just don't want to spray chemicals anymore. Mm-hmm. And I'm not here to, attack any farmer that's currently doing what they want, but I do get back to farmer sovereignty. In a quiet room, I think a farmer would be like, I'm not really happy with the lack of control that I have. They have to be the best technician. They have to buy their own inputs ahead of time and low. They have to get every seed they can. I mean, but they can't be happy about the markets fluctuating like crazy with no control. The seeds are all patented. The sprays are all intertwined with the triple stacks. So, you know, I hope that when commodity farmers see this, and let's say they farm 2,000 acres, all I'm saying is let's pull out a field of 100, move it to transition. We can build a grain program for you to have transitional prices, get to organic. Then you're living in both worlds, your diversified portfolio, which everybody understands and believes in. And so I don't know why it should be any different in farming. And, you know, if it's an older gentleman, because I know our farming age is, you know, our farmers are aging, you know, they're thinking, I don't want to bring on livestock. I mean, I know what that means because I used to do it when I was younger. And that's why they don't, because livestock's hard work. It's the perfect segue to bring on younger kids who want to, you know, scoop snow and manure and raise animals and, you know, not have to have it just be, you know, running a confinement hog building that Smithfield owns, right? Let's let the older generation lead the way and bring on the newer generation to run the chores, you know, to earn their keep and to, you know, work on animal husbandry. That's what we've lost. So anyway,
Well, so where do you see the next steps for 99 counties? And you kind of outline where things are at this point. What are the big pieces moving ahead?
Yeah, we're going to launch. So we're, you know, finalizing. I mean, I needed to start another business, but I mean, there's a million decisions from now till September 1st.
Yep.
We're building a new platform, tech platform. We're changing, you know, logo, packaging. We're working on live animals being harvested in some new, there's a new beef processing plant in Comanche just by Clinton, the Nave family, fantastic people to work with. They're going to, you know, slaughter the beef. They need all the help they can get. Like they're opening at the right place at the right time. They're seeing that, you know, they need their own sovereignty, right? They need to be able to control where their animals get processed and who they can market to. And then there's some other Iowa processors that we're working with. So I just see us onboarding more and more farmers later this year, hopefully next spring and summer, filling the gaps. I need a bunch of grass-fed beef next spring, summer. That's kind of my hole right now. But I'm also finding there's just not a lot of those bigger, you know, medium to small, not boutique small, like six head, but there's just not a lot of those farmers left. I mean, and a lot of them are, you know, direct marketing, but and think about every county, how it used to be. And I get a lot of that from my dad, but every farmer used to have beef cows, sows, you know, five crops, six crops, three or four species of animals.
Yeah.
We need to move to that direction. It won't be easy. It's because it's almost like we've lost so much of that, you know, we got to almost, you know, evoke some of our ancestral knowledge to say, let's do that. But think about the timing of the global, your swear word, but I mean, it's crazy. The world it's only going to get worse, in my opinion. And now is the time you want food, local food can feed local people. Like you want to, it's as simple as that.
Absolutely.
We shouldn't rely on cargo ships to unload food to bring to Iowa.
That's right.
You know, I know we have winter, but you know.
Yeah. So one of our questions asks, how did food awareness during the pandemic affect your thinking about getting this started? And I think it's referring to the fact that so many people saw the vulnerabilities in our food system, and we're looking at what, you know, we're thinking, there's got to be a better way than dealing with all those vulnerabilities that were exposed. Did the pandemic and food awareness come into your thinking when you were working on 99 counties?
Well, I had most of the plan ready and we were already working on it. And then COVID hit and it was like, wow. Perfect place, perfect timing.
Yeah.
Now the high grain prices, you know, are affecting some of that onboarding, I think. But no, this is, I mean, if it's not clear to people that you can't rely on Costco to feed you forever, if the trucks stop rolling or you have weather problems or there's going to be a diesel shortage, I heard on the East Coast. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I thought people might have learned a couple of years ago, but I don't know. I don't know if that seed was planted deep enough in enough people. I'm sure the people listening right now and that will hear this are, you know, people that understand that food tastes better and is healthier and is more enriching when it's grown closer to your home or even by yourself. But I'm talking about the people in the cities. I just don't get that sense when I talk to them. So.
Sure. Sure. So, but you're working on onboarding and moving in that direction. How does, another question asked, you know, how does, the attention we're trying to pay to climate smart farming fit into all of this? It's certainly all the practices you're talking about fit into climate smart farming, it sounds like.
Yeah, it does. I mean, when you have healthy soils, it all starts there because you're going to have better water retention. You're, you know, with the roll down rye.
Yep.
And soybeans, you've got a no-till system. I mean, we work the ground a little bit before we put our corn in, but we're not there for very long. And I'd almost like to get away from corn a little bit because you can do hybrid rye to feed to hogs, which is almost a 1-to-1 ratio in yield and price scenario. So yeah, we're completely climate friendly. I know some other guys are doing a lot of rye, planting of rye. But you know, it doesn't get very tall, you know, and then they spray with glyphosate, which we're not going to support glyphosate just because I think it's a bigger issue than what maybe people realize. And it's what our customers want. So, I mean, not just me personally, but, you know, it's what people want is to move towards I call it a biological system way of farming, which is kind of how it was, you know, pre World War II or right around that time before big ag, you know, big war, big machine kind of came back with all the manpower and that they could muster and then kind of started big farming. So, and I don't begrudge all that. I just think that I think we need better leadership, at government and corporate levels. And I just think we haven't had a lot of leadership on either side. I mean, I just don't think there's a lot of solutions being proposed. So I'm not going to wait for it to be a top down. I think it has to be a grassroots movement. And then people just can understand that if they want to spend $100 to $200 on food each month, and that wouldn't be all their calories, but if they just make that commitment and they get 10 to 15 pounds of really delicious meat, if we had 1 million people do that each month, you can run the numbers, take 1 million people that commit to that times $150 times 12, you get a $1 billion business.
That's right.
And I've run numbers. We could feed 1 million people. We wouldn't even be the whole state of Iowa.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, we can produce a lot of food.
That's right. So. And, Nick, you started, by talking about how you're looking at markets in Chicago, as one example. There's a question asking about, if the idea is to kind of stick with that area or is it, meant to go to, other target market areas?
Sure. So we're fleshing out, a home delivery system. Mm-hmm. So like probably Speedy for Iowa, next day delivery, home to your home. Cause people are just busier and busier. Right now I sell off the back of the truck in designated spots. So like last night I was in Clive in Des Moines and, you know, 25 people come and pick up. But I think home delivery is probably the way to go, not necessarily FedEx, but through the last mile type third party logistics.
Sure.
Chicago is our target. And then we won't saturate that necessarily, but we're going to put our flag there and then we're going to tweak everything and make sure we're running smoothly and be able to produce, you know, beyond Chicago. And then as soon as we're ready, we'll go to, if you just put Iowa in a circle of one day's driving back, you hit Kansas City, Des Moines, Omaha, Minneapolis, Milwaukee, yeah. St. Louis. I mean, there's what, 40 million people in a circular. So, I mean, we better get busy because
That's
we're going to need a lot of farmers, but that's the goal. Yep.
Well, good. Well, this has been a wonderful conversation. We won't be able to get to all of our question and answer, but we wanted to make sure that we left people with contact information in the chat. I think you saw the website to reach out to 99 counties. And Nick, I think you were able to put in your contact information as well. And we're going to look forward to seeing more and more information as we get closer to rollout. So please, let's stay in touch and let's get the good word out to people.
This is just the beginning. I mean, I really want to, I want to be doing some town halls all over the place, encouraging building a community, farmer community, artisan food maker community, and consumers, right? And all of those can interplay with each other. So, you know, that's what we're really trying to do, is to close the gap between that person's plate and, you know, the soil. So it's going to be my best shot at it.
That's right. Well, great. Well, thanks again, Nick. We really appreciate you being with us today. I know it's just the start of a conversation, but boy, it's the start of something that's really exciting. So thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. And thanks for everybody watching. Appreciate it.
Yeah. And have a good afternoon. And thanks everyone for being with us. This is the Iowa Farmers Union Lunch and Learn series. It's part of our education and outreach activities we do as part of the Iowa Farmers Union. Thank you for being an Iowa Farmers Union member. And if you haven't had a chance to be a member, please sign up today. Go to iowafarmersunion.org and sign up today. Be a member, be a supporter to deal with all the issues with regenerative agriculture and family farm agriculture and sustainable agriculture. We know that we are most effective when we work together. So get engaged with your other Iowans and be a part of the Iowa Farmers Union today. So
you've been listening to Nick Wallace of the Farm Organization 99 Counties from a Lunch and Learn seminar by Aaron Lehman of the Iowa Farmers Union.
There's a new program on KHOI.
My name is Deb Rigger, host and producer of Moccasin Tracks. I want to thank you for listening and supporting the original people in music and art, respect and balance. Independently produced for Community Radio.
That's Wednesday at 7 p.m.